Good afternoon, I'm Kathy Lewis. No, we didn't pull the wrong theme music. Our computer just rebooted, and so Victor, being the genius that he is, said this is our only option for the Hearsay Band today, our old theme music. You know what is likely to kill more Virginians this year than car accidents? Heroin addiction. And if your image of heroin addiction comes from the streets of the 1970s, we'll offer you an updated and alarming picture of opioid abuse today, and we'll consider the work of a newly established Hampton Roads Heroin Working Group. Let's talk about it after this news from NPR. Good afternoon. I'm Kathy Lewis. I'm so glad you're with us today. We have a very important show today. We like to think they're all important, of course. But today's is especially important because we know that there is a real problem with heroin in this community and in the Commonwealth. There's a lot of focused attention on this issue, and we want to talk about your stories and your experiences of heroin addiction today. And as we said at the top of the show, if you sort of have an image of this from, you know, bad movies from the 1970s about what that looks like. I hope by the end of the show, you will understand that it is so much more, so much different, so much more dangerous. And it's really wrecking the lives of families. And so we're hoping that you'll give us a call and let us hear from you today at 440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240. Believe it or not, drugs were actually on the scene before the Civil War, but it wasn't until that conflict that veterans whose injuries were treated with morphine got hooked on the drug. And then in 1898, the Bayer Company started producing another opioid called heroin, and it was considered a real wonder drug used for everything from pain killing to cough suppression. And as you might imagine, it wasn't long before folks figured out that you could amplify its effects by injecting it. By 1914, the government put a national narcotics tax on the making, importing, or sale of opiate derivatives. And by the 1920s, doctors knew they had a problem because so many people were becoming addicted. And by 1924, heroin was illegal. Things got so bad in the 70s and 80s that President Ford set up a task force to study the problem. It emphasized focusing less on marijuana and cocaine and more on heroin. And by the late 70s, Percocet and Vicodin came on the scene at the same time. There emerged concern about pain management and a shift in the medical community that came to look at pain as sort of a fifth vital sign. And there was a real push to do a better job of treating chronic pain. Well, by 1996, OxyContin hit the market as a long-term pain reliever. And the result of that is that between 1999 and 2013, prescriptions quadrupled, enough for everyone to have their own bottle of painkillers. I suspect if you looked in your medicine cabinet right now, if you are not someone who is addicted, then you might find a bottle of some of the painkillers that we've described in the course of our program so far. We're at 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. The problem is so challenging in Hampton Roads that there has been developed a task force to take a look at this, a working group to take a look at this that brings together folks from the law enforcement community, folks from the medical community, people who've been affected, community leaders, educators, and the like. We've had more than 300 people in Hampton Roads overdose on drugs between January and June of this year. 65 of those overdoses have been fatal. Those are the ones that principally relate to heroin and prescription painkillers. And as we said at the top of the show, if nothing changes, we're on pace to have more than 1,000 deaths this year from heroin and prescription painkillers in the Commonwealth. And Virginia's Attorney General Mark Herring says that's even more than we might begin to expect from car crashes. And so in September, the Attorney General and U.S. Attorney Dana Buente, who's the top prosecutor for the Eastern District, had a meeting, the first time ever, called the Hampton Roads Heroin Working Group to highlight the need for solutions. And we're talking with some of the folks who are engaged in that effort. Certainly, there have been any number of stories about this, and we want to know what your personal story is, your personal relationship is to heroin addiction. Maybe you have someone in your family who struggles with that. Maybe this is something that you've experienced yourself. And what approach do you think makes sense to tackle this issue? 440-2665-1-800-940-2240. Of course, there's a great question on the table and certainly a shift in the continuum about whether we consider this a law enforcement issue or a public health issue or a little bit of both. 440-2665-1-800-940-2240. We're glad to have Carolyn Weems back with us today. She's a Virginia Beach School Board member, and she's had her own, a member of this outreach team we've just described. And Carolyn, you've had your own painful journey on this question of heroin, on this issue of heroin.
Yes, we sure did. And 3 years ago, we lost our 21-year-old daughter to a heroin overdose. And I can tell you, I would never imagine how hard it is. It doesn't get easier. Mm. So I'm really on the outreach team to focus on education and prevention because I think that is key. And I just want to say that the face of heroin is so different. You know, we did things right. My husband and I have been married for 35 years. We raised 5 children. We ate dinners together. They were involved with sports. We went to church. We read at nighttime
tick,
to
tick,
them.
Tick, tick, tick. You ticked the list. Yeah.
And my daughter had a back injury, and we tried sports rehab. We did. We flew her to Baylor University twice for reflexologists. We had her to stop playing soccer, but she had a chronic back injury. And then I tell people, finally, the doctor prescribed her heroin that was called Dilaudid. Mm. And then they prescribed her Percocet, and there the journey began. So she got addicted to pain medicine. And before we knew it, someone introduced her to heroin. And 3 months later, she died.
Oh, I'm so, so sorry.
Yeah, it's just a tragic. And we see it all the time. I've been to 4 funerals in the last 3 weeks of youngsters, a salutatorium from VCU, a baseball player that had a scholarship at Old Dominion, and again, they died. And most of the time, it's they get addicted to these pain medicines.
Sure.
And we were not aware of how dangerous they were.
That's what I was wondering about. In your own case, when she was being prescribed, you said heroin called Dilaudid. I thought that was a very interesting way to phrase that. When did you, or did you, have a sense that she was becoming addicted to these physician-prescribed medications?
Oh, it wasn't. She had been taking pills for quite a while before we had any idea. And then she.
And what was your clue, if I may ask that?
Our clue was that our son had a baseball injury, and he was home rehabbing. He got hit in the face and had 28 screws to rebuild his face, and he was on pain medicine, and he took one. He doesn't take pain medicine. He was unlike Caitlin, and she stole his medicine. So that was our first clue. And he was very angry, and he discovered it. So then we started doing investigating, and she had been to different doctors and had a lot more pain medicine than we realized.
And describe that transition, because you say she had these physician prescribed. I think that's where a lot of people sort of get stuck on this. Well, the doctors prescribed it, so it must be okay.
That's what we thought. And finally, after that, we realized it. I called the doctors. I asked them not to prescribe it. They said it was basically none of my business because she was over 18. And so I then called the insurance company to try to flag opioids. They said it couldn't happen. And so finally, I told the doctor that you were prescribing medicine to an addict. And it will be on your, you know, your shoulders. We tried to get her in several rehabs. And one awful story that I have here is locally we tried to get her somewhere. And she had been 3 days without any pain medicine. When we were doing the assessment, she was sweating, obviously in withdrawal. And they asked Caitlin, they had the list of about 10 painkillers that she was on or had taken. And they asked her, well, when's the last time you took something? And she said, 3 days ago. And they said, well, you don't qualify for our program because you're not a current drug user.
Oh, wow.
So the frustrations that we have faced, and she was very forthcoming after this. She was not hiding anything. And we were involved, and we couldn't get, you know, the adequate help.
So where was the transition from these prescription drugs to what we would call street drugs, street heroin.
I think it got we really cut off her means of money and supply. Once we found out, so then she was getting them from friends. She was doctor shopping.
Yes,
I'm going to different doctors, so she had a lot more. And then one of her friends said, well, it's basically the same thing, which it is. I remember with Mark Herron came to my house one time and we had
Attorney General.
Yeah, and we had 10 addicts in my living room. And they're basically saying what happens, and this happened to Caitlin, is you're taking heroin in a prescribed pill form, and then it doesn't produce the effects quick enough. And so your friend, in quotes, says, well, why don't you try snorting it or smoking it or skin popping it? And then they do all that. And then the next thing is injection, because you can get the feelings, very quickly. And if you're in that chronic pain, and soon the prescription, the medicine takes over your brain. So it just completely hijacks.
The medicine starts driving it.
Yeah, it just completely hijacks it. And these addicts and Caitlin, they say, and I kept saying, I can't get my head around still that my daughter would put a needle in her arm. And these addicts said, we still can't believe it. But the drug is so powerful that it changes the whole chemistry of your brain. Yeah. And if you don't take it, you are so sick. One young gentleman said it's like having the flu, the worst flu, 100 times over. Because now you don't, and these adults, no matter what age, you're not taking this drug to feel good and feel happy. You're taking it because, first of all, to relieve pain, and then your body has to have it. You are so sick you can't function. Mm. My daughter wasn't on it long. My daughter was actually working. You would never be able to tell,
Very high functioning.
Never be able to tell at all.
It's a painful and hard story, Carolyn Weems. Yes. A painful and hard story. Carolyn Weems, the Virginia Beach school board member, parent of an overdose victim, and a member of the outreach team. She's also engaged in a foundation called Protecting Children, and we'll talk a little bit about that in the course of our program as well. First, though, we're at 17 minutes past the hour, and want to know what you think about what you've just heard. It's really it is an extraordinarily complex problem. Joel Davis is with us by phone today. He's supervisory special agent for the FBI, a supervisor of the Tidewater Violent Crimes Task Force, and a member of the law enforcement team. Joel Davis, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Kathy.
You're welcome. You've just heard Carolyn's story, and I know you know it and others like it so well. I wonder if you would talk about this from what seems to be a real intersection between criminality and medical need and public health.
Well, like you're saying, it crosses all borders. There's so many different avenues to this problem that it just can't be solved by one agency, one section of the community. And we, specifically at the FBI and with the DEA, we're looking at the organizations that are primarily dealing street-level heroin or heroin itself, not the pill form as much. Mm-hmm. And we're focusing our investigations on enterprises that are using violence in association with their distribution.
And how big a problem is that?
It's a huge problem. We're losing dozens of people a year to a heroin overdose.
I guess what I'm wondering about, though, is the violent aspect of this, because I think so many of these stories that we hear, we certainly have an image of that, but then we also hear a story like Carolyn's, where violence in the way I think you often deal with it is not at play. I wonder if you could give us a sense of where this becomes violent.
Well, you have the two aspects of violence. You have the simple fact that somebody's distributing a drug that results in the death of another individual. Mm-hmm. That, by definition, is a violent drug trafficking organization or an individual. You also have people that are engaged in what you commonly see in the news and on movies and everything else regarding heroin distribution, where it's such a money maker that there's a lot of violence associated with collection of debts owed, violence towards people the dealers believe to be sources to law enforcement, violence associated with stealing those drugs from other drug dealers. So it's a whole triangle of violence.
Yeah. This is such a great point. We're at 440-2665 or 1-800-940 2240. Patrick Hartig with us in the studio today. He's a supervisory special agent for the DEA. I wonder about the same sort of angle from you, Patrick Hartig. What do you see, and where do you see this connected to public health? Because you're working on this task force that sort of seeks to bring those issues together.
And I would just echo what Joel had mentioned. It's definitely a public health problem. What we're seeing today in the current market with heroin and fentanyl is a less diluted, more potent product, which is contributing to the overdose statistics here locally.
Yeah. You mentioned fentanyl, and we have not introduced that in the conversation, but it's very much related to what we're talking about. So would you unpack that for us a little bit?
It absolutely is. It's definitely an emerging threat that we have to deal with. Fentanyl is a Schedule II synthetic opioid. It's approximately 100 times stronger than morphine, and probably 60 to 80 times more potent than heroin. It is produced in China or in clandestine laboratories in Mexico, and then imported into the United States for distribution. Only 2 milligrams of fentanyl can prove to be a lethal dose. So it's a very, very powerful drug, and it's oftentimes being distributed as heroin. So
you would think you might be getting heroin, and you're getting something that's so many times more powerful.
That is very common here locally and throughout the United States, where the user of the substance isn't aware that he or she is even ingesting fentanyl. They believe it's heroin, and often heroin is being mixed with fentanyl, which makes the product even more potent and more dangerous.
Am I correct in this? I think fentanyl is also the drug that is used by anesthesiologists, or a form of that. Because I know there was a problem about 20 years ago, don't know if it's still a problem, with anesthesiologists diverting fentanyl that was intended for patients. Is it the same sort of deal? Obviously in a different form and grade.
It's definitely a different form of grade, and that was a problem at one time. I'd say that we're trending away from that because...
But more on the street now.
More on the street now, and it's more available. It's easier to obtain since the Mexican organizations are producing fentanyl in mass quantities. So the difficulties of trying to extract fentanyl from patches and diverting it from the medical community, it's more... complex. It's easier for a distributor to establish a source of supply that can supply them with significant quantities of fentanyl.
We should note that federal prosecutors said that in June of 2014, a 49-year-old Newport News man died after using fentanyl that he thought was heroin. A Hampton dealer was later convicted and sentenced to 22 years in that death. So a piece of this is about making that linkage and dealing with supply issues. We're glad to have Patrick Hartig with us today. John Butler is Assistant U.S. Assistant Attorney General and Special Assistant U.S. Attorney, working with the coordinated group. He's helped coordinate this group that's come together to really address this. John Butler, nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Kathy.
Can you talk to us a little bit about the law? Because it's a very important point to make that these are federal crimes.
They are, and there are state crimes as well, but I'm working from the federal angle. So we knew we had a very big problem in the last couple of years. As you stated, this is now the leading cause of accidental death in the Commonwealth. It's surpassed car accidents.
It has already.
It has. And Hampton Roads leads the Commonwealth in overdose death. So we know that we have this significant problem. So the Attorney General, Mark Herring, and the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District, Dana Bente, partnered in late of 2014. They said, we've got to put state and federal resources together to attack this. So there were some resources put here in Hampton Roads, and we aggressively went after these heroin trafficking organizations. But what we came to realize is that you just can't prosecute your way out of this problem, and that it takes a multi-pronged approach, which is sort of the birth of this working group. We realize that we've got to partner up with the medical community, mental health professionals, social workers, educators, stakeholders from all across this region. So in September, the Attorney General and the U.S. Attorney Bente announced the working group, and we're getting started. So we've already met once. We're going to meet in December, and then we're going to meet quarterly throughout 2017.
Trying to come up with some recommendations around this.
That's absolutely right.
25 minutes past the hour. Edward's on the line from Norfolk. Hi, Edward. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. Go right ahead.
I've been clean for 6 years.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. I was an intravenous drug user, and I got assistance from the Department of Corrections in getting clean for my crimes, you know, attributed to my drug use. And a lot of what I've seen, especially after losing more friends than I can count, is that an addict actually recover. It's multiple steps. There has to be long-term abstinence, a solid support structure, and then the person has to find a purpose within themselves in order to continue to make it every day.
What's been that purpose for you, Edward?
My life changed as far as like my outlook on drugs the day that I lost my best friend.
Oh.
I was sitting in prison when I called home to check in and found out that he had passed away 2 days before.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Ever since that moment, I knew that prison and using drugs was just not the life that I wanted to live. I wanted to have more for myself. I wanted to achieve my full potential. And I'm just, it's very like disheartening to have something like the loss of a close friend be that catalyst.
Sure. You said that you got help through the Department of Corrections. One of the things we have heard anecdotally is it's very hard to get treatment, but you were in the system. How was that for you?
Absolutely terrible. Mm. Absolutely terrible. They do offer rudimentary treatment, but nothing along the scope of what people actually need. I took it upon myself to look hard at my life and the choices that I had made that brought me to that place and really, really try to change. I mean, it started by just exercising regularly, trying to eat properly,
Sure.
just trying to take care of myself and my soul.
Yeah. Edward, wow, that's a very impressive story. I hope you are... And you say you were 6 years clean. I hope you have found a life's purpose that keeps you clean.
Oh, it's absolutely beautiful. I have a trade that I'm very successful in. I'm completely financially independent. I live on my own. I am working towards my bachelor's degree in engineering. It's just...
Congratulations.
Life is beautiful.
That's
but
a huge...
Has to be... Go ahead.
No, go ahead. You said there has to be?
There has to be... For all the you know the families out there who are dealing with something like addiction, it's not just place them in a rehab facility. There has to be like that support structure. There has to be
sure.
a lot of work going on within that person in order for them to be successful.
I hear you,
not...
Edward. I thank you for your call. I've got two other calls I got to get in before the break, but I want to put you on hold if we may, and get your contact information because. You know, we always have to hold up stories where there has been a successful outcome. They're rare and they need to be more common. So I'm going to get your information so we can talk further to you, Edward. Thank you for the call. Anita's on the line from Moyock. Hi, Anita. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to know about what the panel thinks about legalizing marijuana for chronic pain.
Okay.
My girlfriend's father is taking opioids now that the mother is taking all the time, and he finds no relief. And I said to ask your doctor about medical marijuana. I mean, my nephew has been hooked on heroin, and the opioids, to me, is just out of control.
Yeah, I hear you. I think there's a lot of agreement on that, not necessarily as much agreement on the question of legalizing marijuana. I'm going to put that question in the parking lot for the moment because we've got some folks that can speak to that. But I have to take a quick break, and I want to make sure that we are thoughtful with the response to that. So, Anita, we will come back to that question a little bit later in the broadcast. Bob's on the line from Gloucester. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
Listen, I got a couple of points here. Let me make the first point. I am a sufferer of chronic pain, and I take prescribed pain medication. And I want to emphasize a couple of things. It does not make me high, but what it does do is it enables me to function in a physical environment. What I do is I work on boats, and if in periods when I run out of my pain medicine, I'm unable to work full day.
Got
I have
it.
To take frequent breaks. So the drugs don't make me high. They don't make me euphoric. What they do is they push the pain down to a level that I can work a regular day. Without the drugs, my body fights the pain and it exhausts me. That's
got it. That's
five.
A really good, that's a very good way to describe that. Bob, I got time for one more point before I have to take a break.
I keep hearing the hysterical arguments on the radio and the TV and in the newspaper. And I very much distrust what I'm hearing. I don't see any use of illegal drugs and heroin. I don't see any bodies in the street. I don't know anybody who is using this stuff. One of your guests says, we lose dozens of people per year to heroin. Dozens of dozens out of a population in excess of 300 million is insignificant, although it's significant to the individual families.
Bob, I want to thank you for your call. I think it points up so much that really has to do with larger issues as well. One of the things I've noticed doing this broadcast for many years now is that we are increasingly having a tendency to doubt the experience of others because it has not been our experience. And I respect and appreciate what your explanation of what these medicines do for you. And if we have left the impression that people are taking these so that they can get high, we definitely want to take that expectation off the plate, because we know that there are people who live with chronic pain. And we know that was a beautiful way you described that, about it pushes the pain down long enough for you to be able to do your work. I very much appreciate that. But I think if you were to talk to Carolyn Weems or any of the other 300 folks in Hampton Roads whose families have dealt with the impacts of this, an overdose is one thing, but you would have to understand that families are dealing with this across the region. I can't tell you the number of people who have said to me privately, this is embarrassing, I don't want to talk about this, but my adult child is addicted, my teenager is addicted. And I hope you will keep listening, because we can't be in a moment where we doubt everybody's experience because it's not our own. So stay with us. We'll continue the story on the other side of a quick check-in with Pledge Central.
A very good afternoon to you. Dwight Davis with Wayla Shambo in our Pledge studio with our volunteers, waiting for your support for some of the finest programming on the radio. And that would be Hearsay with Kathy Lewis here on WHRV Monday through Thursday during the noon hour. Very important, very moving discussion today. Kathy's show, though, covers a wide range of topics, political and sometimes it gets downright funny, but today we're being very serious, and we're serious, too, in the effort to raise money for this sort of programming. This is quality programming. You're not going to find it elsewhere on the dial here in Hampton Roads, except on your several WHRV NPR stations. If we are coming to you right now when you have the opportunity to call in and pledge your support or go online, and we'd like you to do that. We'd like to get another $300 or so by the end of this show to keep on track for the goal for today. So, 889-9476 is the number to call, or whrv.org online. We'll thank you with some very nice gifts, and Wayla can tell you about them.
That's right. Well, this week, Hearsay is celebrating a very special anniversary. It's 20th anniversary on the air here on WHRV, and we have some special thank you gifts available to celebrate that show, the host, and the station that you love. If you contribute in honor of Hearsay, you can get a very nice Hearsay coffee mug that's available for only $5 a month. And you know as well that your money is going to support the great programming that you enjoy every day of the year here on WHRV.
Show where your sympathies lie. Go to work with a WHRV Hearsay mug, and your friends will say, wow, you listen to that show? And you can say, yeah, I do. Do you? And they'll say, yeah. And then you say, are you a member? That's how it works. 889-9476 if you want to become a member. WHRV, and this program in specific, is what we'd like to call an oasis from all the noise out there. A lot of things on radio, a lot of things on cable, a lot of things online, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What we get here is intelligent discussion, thoughtful coverage of the stories that affect Hampton Roads each and every day, Monday through Thursday. It's the kind of programming that public radio is now known for across the country and around the world. And Kathy is a good part of that here in Hampton Roads. If you agree with us, let us hear from you. Pledge your support. Help us chip away at this $500 goal in the next 25 minutes or so. 889-9476 online, whrv.org.
WHRV gives you stories, news, and insights every day that make you stop and think and also help you start your own conversations. Maybe you've said to friends, I was listening to Hearsay and I heard this story about fill in the blank, any number of topics, and it helps you really have those deeper conversations. So it's not only the headlines, it's not, as Dwight was saying, the noise. It's a deeper, a more thoughtful conversation that you can be part of. Maybe you've called into Kathy's show in the past. Maybe you've called into the Diane Rehm show or some of our other programs, and we're asking you to support that today. 889-9476 or at whrv.org.
Kathy's been at this, that is broadcasting now, for 30 years. She's been host of Hearsay with Kathy Lewis since 1996 and is celebrating 20 years as the host of one of the most listened to shows on the radio here in Hampton Roads. You can call in right now, thank her for the great programming each and every day, Monday through Thursday, and also support the other fine programs on this station. 889-9476, online, whrv.org. Ask about the coffee mug. Ask about the slanket, which we will tell you about next time we talk to you. Again, the numbers, 889-9476. That rings directly in the studios you just heard, or online, whrv.org. Pledge your support and keep great radio on the air here in Hampton Roads.
Welcome back. We're at 24 minutes before the hour, and one of the aspects of this very special week of shows is that we do have to take that break at the bottom of the hour, so I want to make sure that we are fair with all of the calls. So sometimes I'll delay dealing with them till after the break so that we have the fullness of time to explore them. And so let's do that now. Bob called right before we went to the break, and he said he was doubtful of the statistics because he himself doesn't see or know anybody who is in this circumstance. I'm glad to have Dr. Heidi Kuhlberg, the health director for the Virginia Beach Department of Public Health. She's a member of the medical team as well. Dr. Kuhlberg, nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I know there are lots of things that we're going to be talking about in this question of the statistics, in this question of the scope of the problem. But I want to get you to respond, if you will, to what you were hearing from Bob. And again, chronic pain is nothing to laugh at.
Correct. And chronic pain affects between 3 to 6% of Americans on a regular basis at any one point in time. Approximately 12% of U.S. Americans are taking prescribed opioid medication. 12%. Opioid medications as prescribed or appropriately at any one point in time. And I'd have to say, from the medical side, as the Centers for Disease Control guidelines came out in March of this year for prescribing opioids for chronic pain, and they didn't say you can't ever prescribe them. And that's something I just wanted to make clear and reinforce with, you know, some of what Bob was saying. Part of the issue is they have been overprescribed for the past 15
years. Sure, it's a continuum issue.
It's a continuum.
So we're at 440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240. I wanted to adjust your mic for you.
Thank you so much. And what the CDC really advocates is that the patient and the clinician have a relationship. They establish a pain management contract to really look at is what is being prescribed actually working and helping. And I think Bob made a really good point with what you're really looking for is a decrease in pain and an improvement in function. And they've set the threshold at 30%. If you have a 30% decrease in your amount of pain, 30% increase in your amount of function. Are you able to
Yes.
do your work? Are you able to do what you had set out to do? You know, so part of it is actually having a conversation with your physician, setting those goals, and then having really regular visits to make sure that they're being met. And there's a wide variety of being able to do that. And occasionally the opioid pain medicine needs to be a part of it.
We're 20 minutes before the hour. It's 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. John Butler, our caller, had a question about statistics. So we talked a little bit about pain management, getting back to productivity. What can you tell us about those statistics?
One person is dying every 20 minutes. The statistics from 2014, we had 27,000 deaths from heroin and prescription opioid overdoses. And I think what's important to understand, and I'm glad that Bob, you know, that it's a positive thing for Bob, but one thing we have to know is that this problem is intrinsically linked with the prescription opioid problem, and there's some predictors. If you abuse alcohol, you're twice as likely to become a heroin addict. If you abuse marijuana, you're three times as likely to become a heroin addict. If you abuse cocaine, you're 15 times more likely. But if you abuse prescription narcotics, you are 40 times more likely to get into heroin. And what we're seeing is purity is going up and costs are going down. And OxyContin is between $30 and $80 a pill, but you can get that same amount in heroin for $10 to $20. So it's becoming more accessible. And again, the purity, the sure. retail purity, I think in the 1980s was like between 5 and 10%, and now it's 40%. So
yeah,
it's a lot
and I know
dangerous.
Anita had a question earlier about the possibility of legalizing marijuana, and I don't think any of our guests are comfortable commenting on that because of the jobs that they do. But you did note, I think I heard your statistic, was it three times more likely to become addicted if you're already smoking marijuana?
All right.
So that's not a political statement. It just is. That's the use. That's the statistic. Easy for me to say. 19 minutes before the hour. Let's go to Evie on the line from Newport News. Hi, Evie. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I wanted to comment on what Bob said.
Okay.
And I am a person that does take pain pills. I'm under the care of a pain management doctor, and they do everything the doctor said. I have to go every 3 months.
Yeah.
I get tested to be sure I'm not overusing. And we talk about it. But the thought of not being able to have the pain pills when I need them, mm-hmm. and I have cut down to almost just one a day.
Sure.
And so the pain management is working. During the day, I can handle it, but at night, I can't.
Sure.
And so that's when I have to take it.
Understand entirely, and that's often the case with pain, isn't it? That it does get worse at night. Evie, thank you for the call. This Dr. Colbert sounds like Evie's doing exactly what we would hope she would do. And there's another proposal to sort of streamline doctor prescribing so that all of these kinds of drugs get prescribed from one doctor. So you can't do this doctor shopping.
Right. And so they're really looking at your relationship with your primary care physician is a key relationship. You want to make sure that you have that interaction with a single individual who can track you. Now, I will say there are a couple, you know, exceptions in a sense to that rule. And one is if you're going into the emergency room.
Sure, totally different. Yeah.
You know, an accident or something's happened. But the Virginia Healthcare and Hospital Association has just come out with guidelines for emergency room physicians. And it's in alignment with a lot of the CDC
yeah.
guidelines and the national pain strategy that's out there. They're looking at if it is necessary to give an opioid. And first they're looking at non-opioid therapies, you know, different tractions, you know, different non-narcotic
right.
medications. But if they have to give them, giving them for the shortest duration possible, you know, suggesting no more than 3 days, and then making sure that they're contacting, uh-huh. the emergency department is contacting the primary care physician's office, getting the notes there so the primary care doc is aware
so
of what's going
everybody
on.
Everybody knows everything. 15 minutes before the hour, we're at 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Information, the key here. Patrick Hardig is a supervisory special agent with the Drug Enforcement Agency. Patrick, as you think about this from what you're seeing on the streets, what do you think would be the most effective strategies and approaches to curbing the supply and dealing with the demand?
Well, the most effective strategy is what we've done here, which is the formation of this working group. Any strategy that's deployed by any person involved in this working group will have an impact on the other part of the working group.
Right.
So we have to collectively meet and discuss strategies so we can formulate the best plan. What we do from a law enforcement perspective is going to have an impact on the medical community, on the outreach community. Their strategy will have an impact on our community, and then we have the prosecution side of this with John. We all have to be communicating. We have to be working together. We have to be sharing our investigative information,
right,
which is very important. Our partnership with the FBI, the other federal agencies, all the local jurisdictions are participating in this working group.
It's great.
It's pertinent. We have to be working together and sharing information. If we do that, we have a better chance of confronting this problem.
And we should note that Virginia now has an overdose reporting law, and this is really important. So if you report an overdose, you can't be charged with a minor drug possession charge. Have I got that basically right? No, not basically right, kind of, sort of. I think they were trying very hard to get at a scenario where if you were with someone who was having a heroin overdose, that you would not be implicated or charged if you report that. And I think that is the case. At least that's what I recall when the Attorney General was here. Neil is on the line from Chesapeake. Hi, Neil. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just calling because I really have been a prescription pain user for about 21 years. And also, I've had friends that have OD'd, including my best friend who tried to commit suicide because he was hooked on drugs. And I also deliver prescription pain medications for people for a local pharmacy. So I see a lot of aspects of this. As a prescription user myself, I found that when I was able to use cannabis, I didn't have sexual side effects that I have from the prescription pain medicine. And I was just wondering, was there ever something in the works of maybe being able to, say, take the pain medicine when you're at work so you can do your job correctly, and then at night maybe be able to use the cannabis for your pain relief and you don't have the same sexual side effects?
Boy, Neil, I don't know the answer to that, and I don't think we've got anybody here who would know that. That would probably be something to ask your doctor about, and certainly we know there are lots of conversations in the region about decriminalizing marijuana use. And so in terms of those side effects, that's probably something to discuss with your doctor. We're at 12 minutes before the hour. Mary's on the line from Hampton. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Hi, Kathy. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. Go right ahead.
Well, I wanted to, first of all, respond to the caller, Bob, earlier. It hurt me a lot to hear him say the deaths from overdosing were insignificant because I lost my baby brother a few years ago to an overdose.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Also, second, I read a few articles a few months ago outlining the differences in the chemicals, actually, in the medical marijuana and the recreational marijuana, how the THC factor was quite different when it came to medical marijuana. And I wanted to know if there were any thoughts or anything on that.
Yeah. Mary, I'm sorry, I don't think I have anybody here who can really address that question, but it's a good one. And I really appreciate that you talked about your brother and the and sort of hearing that. It's really hard, you know, I think when we deal with statistics, because the fact of the matter is, when it comes to the deployment of resources, statistics are something you have to bear in mind. You want to do the most amount of good for the most amount of people, particularly when you're dealing with public resources. But the fact of the matter is, this really is a problem that is hitting families like yours. And so I thank you for that call. Mark is on the line from Virginia Beach. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Kathy.
Hi.
Thank you. I appreciate this. This is something that's fresh on my mind. We're just over dealing with a detox with my wife.
Really?
My concern, yes. We got caught up in the system, and in my opinion, the whole pain management system is broken. Mm. She's a cancer patient, has bone marrow cancer, which is very difficult to deal with.
Sure.
And she's been bedridden for about the last 7 years.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Recently, she was booted from pain management on an error that they made, and on a drug that she had been prescribed the whole time. She did everything exactly by the book.
Right.
Counted her medications every 3 months when she went in there, did her blood test.
Yeah, so there was a problem with that. Uh-huh.
Yes. Now, when this happened, she was pretty well left out in the cold with no offer of assistance from either pain management or her oncologist or our primary care physician. We went to a new pain management doctor who promptly said, I don't write prescriptions for 6 weeks after you've been my patient.
Sure.
So out of desperation, we were trying to figure out what to do. Now, my wife's a strong person, and she made the decision after a few emergency room visits that she's done with the opioids.
Yeah.
And we did manage to detox, but it was a total nightmare, and nobody in the system offered any assistance. All they want is the money.
I hear you, Mark. That must be so painful, particularly since your wife has a very chronic and very painful condition. I really am sorry. There are moments when we're trying to change things where people do get caught in the crossfire of that, and I'm really sorry that that happened for you. Gail's on the line from Newport News. Hi, Gail. You're on the air.
Hi, Kathy. My son was addicted, or is still an addict, if you know the terminology.
Yes.
He's been for 2 years, and the way I'll spare you all the details, but of his story. But what I wanted to share is that he finally got clean through a program in Richmond called The Healing Place.
Uh-huh.
And it's 100% free. It's an inpatient facility that does not charge. It's from 12 to 18 months. And he had to go through it twice in order to get clean. But I highly recommend it for anyone. It's all men, but they take you regardless of where your station in life.
Yeah.
And they're trying to build a center here in Hampton Roads, but they can't find a location. It's one of those NIMBY problems.
Gail, I'm sorry to have to run along. I really appreciate that. The place is called The Healing Place in Richmond, The Healing Place. In Richmond, if you're interested in more information. And I know so many people who have been down this rehabilitation road, and for your son, it took 2 times. That is not at all unusual. It's a long journey, and I thank you for the call. Gabrielle is on the line from Norfolk. Hi, Gabrielle. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to speak to the use of kratom. I know you have a representative there from the DEA, and I know that was recently has been targeted as something that they want to eliminate the use of.
Sure.
My understanding with kratom is that it doesn't cause, there's no risk of overdose.
Okay. I'm sorry to push you along, Gabrielle, but I want to make sure that we get this in because I've had several calls from people and emails from people about this very issue. It's a plant called kratom, K-R-A-T-O-M. Some scientists say it is a non-addictive alternative to opiates. It's a plant from Southeast Asia. The experiences are fairly similar to opiates like heroin, but supporters of kratom have said that this is really the next generation of painkillers. The DEA has a different idea of that, and the federal regulators on Thursday reversed a decision to ban the use. So it sounds like that process will continue. Do any of you want to comment on that, John Butler or Patrick Hardig? Okay, you don't. Do you know anything about the kratom? Have you ever heard of that?
Well, it's the responsibility of the DEA to schedule controlled substances, and there is a great deal of testing involved with that. So that's going to have to occur first so that anybody can safely say this is actual product that works.
And this is K-R-A-T-O-M if you want to follow this. Dr. Kohlberg, do you know anything about this kratom?
No, I do not.
I have heard from probably 5 or 6 people who want to know more about that, Gabrielle. So I thank you for the call. We'll try to dig into that just a little bit more. But the issue is that on Thursday, federal regulators apparently reversed a decision to ban the use of this plant. DEA is concerned about deaths from that they attribute to kratom. So we'll sort of explore that a little bit more. Morgan is on the line from Gloucester. Hi, Morgan. You're on the air.
Hey, Kathy. Haven't talked with you a while. Great topic. Thank you very much for this. If I could, just a couple of quick comments. Gail mentioned the Healing Place. For goodness sakes, if you get a chance to get a Healing Place in Hampton Roads, please get it. There's one in Louisville, Raleigh, and Richmond. They are fabulous. The thing I wanted to point out, Kathy, it's not going to come as a surprise to you that, you know, the jails are filling up with people with opioid problems, and the jails are not doing very much, if anything, about it. Please, it's an American disgrace to lock people up with addiction problems and not offer them services. Your previous client even said, you know, when he was inside, his best friend overdosed and died. It woke him up, but then he, on his own, stuck with it. And look at the great result that he got.
It was a great result, no question.
Just wanted to make those comments.
Yeah, Morgan, I appreciate it very much. And certainly we know that prisons are healthcare agencies now in many respects, and they are very stressed. But a piece of this conversation about the integration of this working group on this issue is to take a look at some of those issues as well. Carolyn Weems, we started with you. I want to end with you today, if we may. What do you hope in this group? What do you hope this group will accomplish?
Well, I'm on the outreach and, you know, education focus group, and we're really concentrating on education and prevention and really letting people know exactly what an opioid is and addiction, that it's a health crisis, it's not a moral issue. And some things that I'm proud of that we've been able to accomplish is kudos to Amy Cashwell from Virginia Beach Public Schools, because we actually have beefed up the curriculum. All of our ninth graders will be able to watch Heroin, the Hardest Hit.
Which is the Virginia story.
Right, yeah. Right. And then also all of our secondary teachers and staff have watched the FBI's Chasing the Dragon. All ninth graders will see this. There's already lesson plans. The teachers will be able to have appropriate questions and feedback, and the students will be doing projects and really researching opioids and this crisis. Also, all of our police stations in Virginia Beach have take-back boxes. You can take your prescription pills anytime to a police station in Virginia Beach, and you need to clear out your medicine cabinet, because if you have teenagers or anybody in your house,
yes,
medicine, you know, it's in
it
our
winds
medicine.
Up at school,
exactly,
and being sold.
Exactly. In some of our Walgreens, we now have take back boxes. Like I said, our foundation with Tom Bates from RK as president, Protecting Children Foundation, we're doing forums and events to let this information get out. The Virginia Beach Psych Center is partnering to have an event, and even Adams Outdoor Advertising is going to save space for some billboards. So we're really, people are contacting us, and we want people to continue that, because the main thing is to get the word out.
Yes.
It is not a shameful moral issue. It is a disease, and it is taking over. It is evil, and we've got to do something. And I think, you know, it being in the schools, I hope other school divisions, you know, take note and also do the curriculum as well.
Yeah. I tell you, there are so many problems that we face as a culture that are interdisciplinary. They're law enforcement, they're part education, they're part healthcare, they're part of all kinds of things. And one of the things, I go back to Morgan, I think that was Morgan Moss, just an amazing addiction specialist who works, he and his partner Penny Patton work in prisons. That's sort of where they do most of their work around addictions, in prisons. And if you don't think this is all interconnected, you're not paying attention. Mm-hmm. It absolutely is. And it is at every socioeconomic level. It's in every, both genders, all genders, all races, all socioeconomic levels, on the street, in your home. It's everywhere. And if you don't think it is, talk to your kids, talk to your young adults, and find out more about this task force. Where could people learn more about the task force if they're, we'll find that out. We'll post it on our Facebook page. If you check our Facebook page in a few moments as well, we will have some. I hope Carolyn will be all right if we posted some pictures of her,
her
beautiful daughter, who was a victim of heroin overdose. So thank you so much for your thoughts and your calls and your contributions today. This is why it's important to do this, because this is the place where we're having a regional conversation about a regional problem. So I hope that you heard something that really caused you to pay attention to this and really caused you to check out your medicine cabinet, take all that old medicine out and dispose of it properly in some of these citywide options that are available to you. Up next on 89.5, it's Making Contact, and then it's the Antiques Roadshow tonight at 8 and 9 on WHRO TV 15. Thanks for listening.